Blog Talk Radio.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man. You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the measuring stick. Let's go hook him up!
Another edition of Over the Top Radio. I am your host, Ed, in San Antonio, and I'm joined by my co-host, Craig. What's going on, Craig?
I'm doing well. Good to be back on the show. How are you guys doing this evening?
Well, let me get Couture on the line so he can say he's fine. Couture, how you doing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There he is.
Okay. Yeah. So. Yeah, I guess we're all doing okay. So what's going on? What's happening?
Doing radio on a Friday night. Should be out doing something fun. Doing radio on a Friday night.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you don't have a life. We get stuck doing the show. But it's okay because at least we're not alone because unfortunately there are hundreds and hundreds of other people who don't have a life who listen to our show also.
We thank you for not having a life and tuning in.
Absolutely. Thank you, listeners.
I think we all just called them losers, but thank you for tuning in every day, every week.
Yeah, thanks for tuning in. So, anyway, Craig, you skipped out on the show again for, like, I think the second time in 3 weeks. To go to a 90-year-old party. I mean,
95.
Man, you are one rocking dude.
95, and it was my grandfather. I kind of had to go. So,
I would hope so.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be class one.
It very well could be, actually.
Well, he's had plenty, so it's not like, you know, he's missed out. I mean, sounds like a nice long life there.
Yeah, that's totally true. But, it was a good time, I think. I mean, as far as 95-year-old birthday parties go to. Oddly enough, I went to his sister's 101st last year.
Wow. That's that's an old family there.
Yeah, I've come from some good stock, which is good because I'm slowly destroying myself.
Yeah, you need to take care of yourself a little bit better there, Craig.
Yeah, probably.
I'm sure you have
dead. I'll probably follow in their footsteps. I'll be dead soon.
Good to know.
Yeah, you need to take care of yourself, Craig, because we all found out what Vinny's body fat percentage was. And
right.
You're no fatter than Vinny there, Craig. You're probably a lot fatter than Vinny there. So
I bet you my body fat is lower than Vinny's.
Than who?
Vinny's.
Oh, Vinny's.
Yeah.
I don't know about that, Craig, because you're more rounder than Vinny is. I haven't seen Vinny since Vegas, so.
I've got, shoulders and stuff like that. Vinny's kind of, he's kind of fat all over. Just fat in the gut.
You know what's funny, though, is, like, the second Vegas trip, which would have been 4 years ago, Vinny was actually pretty lean and slim at that time.
Yeah, well, with most fat people, you know, they kind of peak and valley, you know, every so often.
Yeah.
Vinny's lucky he's tall.
Right. Same here. You know.
Yeah, that does help out, doesn't it? Because there's like me, since I'm a little shorter than y'all, you know.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I definitely carry my weight better than Vinny does.
That's a matter of his opinion, but I need to send out some shout-outs here. So I need to send out a shout-out to Mr. Sir Highlight, because he got me one very, very, very nice room in Houston for not very much, considering what night it was and where it was in Houston. I mean, this is probably a suite. I mean, it was one of the most spacious suites I've ever been in, and he actually finally found me one with a balcony, so.
Right.
I was able to go to a certain UFC show very stoned out of my mind, and then after that was pretty awesome.
I love the way Ed sugarcoats things.
Yeah, and a shout out to Matt Clary, because he's the one who had got the tickets, and I actually still owe Matt a little money. And don't worry, Matt, it's coming on. I got you. It's coming. And then a shout out to that jerk Rodney.
It's his birthday today.
Yeah, it's his birthday today. That I don't even know how old that jerk is. How old is he?
27. I have no idea. Okay. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, now there's people going to go to, well, hey, happy 27th birthday, Rodney.
Right.
They'll be like, what are you talking about?
let's see. I can look this up here. I bet you he's old enough not to put it on his Facebook page. What do you want to bet?
It's weird because he didn't actually even have, it didn't actually show that it was his birthday today.
No, it didn't, actually.
No, it didn't for a while. For a while, it didn't. And then, like, a few people started wishing him happy birthdays. And then I think he went and changed it, and then it actually did show it. But.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I have no idea how old he is because it doesn't say on his page. So.
Yeah. And you know, black guys, they actually sometimes get younger than they actually are, so. Not that he's really that black, but he's still somewhat black. But,
sure.
Anyway, I also got to, I got to meet a couple. It's funny, though, because I marked out for two people this weekend. Well, actually kind of three, but two of them, and they actually weren't fighters. I actually marked out and went and got pictures with Stitch, the corner man from USC, and also...
Sure.
Also, Tracy Lee, who is that awesome, beautiful photographer with the giant tube lenses sticking out at the gateside taking pictures. And she actually remembered me from the WC show that was here. So that was actually pretty cool. So those were my mark-out moments. I also got to meet Meathead from the former Ultimate Fighter.
Matt Mitrione.
Mitrione. And that was actually pretty cool. And it was actually a pretty, pretty good weekend this past weekend.
Nice. There were good fights on last weekend. I really enjoyed that show.
Yeah, it was actually kind of, so the prelims were pretty much, it seemed like they were all decisions, and it was kind of seeming that it was going to be kind of like the show I went to in May, that was one of the most boring shows that I ever went to. In fact, I was apologizing for even taking Barbara to the show and wasting her time for that. And this show kind of started the same way, but as soon as the main show started, I mean, the atmosphere was like totally different. It was awesome. I mean, it was pretty damn exciting. And Lance Storm's favorite MMA fighter won, and then cut one of the greatest promos ever in the history of UFC after the fight. And that was fucking awesome.
Very true. Yeah, it was a great, great show. Hey, but listen, I told Luke we would give him a call early in the show, so why don't you go take care of that?
Okay, Mr. Producer, dude.
Mr. Producer guy. Oh, what would he do without me?
Okay. Well, you guys talk. So I am dialing right now.
Great. Yeah. From his home phone, apparently.
No, I'm using the same phone I always use.
No, it's not.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry, I had it on the wrong
screen. Three stars on Angry Birds.
Yeah. I already beat them all in the new limousine release for Angry Birds Real. Because I'm awesome.
I just cleared all of them the other day so I could play them again.
Call Luke. So, Trey, what did you think of Raw?
That was something else.
That's the nicest way anybody's put it all week.
People hated it way more than I did. I didn't hate it that much. I just thought it was stupid. I didn't have anger like Brian does.
Right.
I don't let
nobody does.
Anger me anymore, so I'm over that shit.
You know, it's funny because, like, the first segment, I wasn't really bothered by it. I thought it was kind of...
I was all for like Sheamus and John Cena wrestle with Punk on commentary.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that part of the show was fine, and as soon as they hired Laurinaitis, then it went quickly downhill. But
I don't know if there's ever been a show with more plot holes in it.
Mm. Yeah. You would.
There has to have been an impact that bad before, but I don't know.
I'm pretty sure there was, but yeah, lots of holes in the storylines there.
Yeah.
Not as bad as.
But they need to do some sort of reboot next week or something. I don't know.
Just treat it like the Vince McMahon.
Cancel all that out.
Treat it like the Vince McMahon limo blowing up.
Yeah, let's take a
break. Go ahead and introduce our guest for us.
Our guest tonight went from violently busting open the heads of men to licking the heads of young children. Please welcome the former sheep herder and bushwhacker, Luke Williams.
Whoa, g'day, mates. It's bloody great to be on your show tonight. You're looking good, mate. I mean, you don't smell too great. Smell like a bucket of sardines.
Greatest interview so far. How are you doing tonight, Luke?
Oh, bloody lovely for your mother.
She might already know.
Now, Luke, I'm actually calling from San Antonio, and I actually got to watch you for quite a few years in the early 80s here in San Antonio, and I'd like to start off by asking, what were your thoughts of working for Southwest Championship Wrestling?
Oh, it was great, mate. It was great. The situation wasn't the greatest when I came in there. My partner, Butch, was back home in New Zealand doing a little business at home and that, and I came in with Jonathan Boyd, an ex Royal Kangaroo. And within the first 6 weeks, he had a bad car wreck just down the road from where we were living, and which put him out. He was in a body cast for 6 months. So I actually ran by myself for the first, say, 4 to 6 months in single matches, and then Butch came back and joined me, and the sheep herders were back in full swing, and then Jonathan came in as our manager.
Now, when Jonathan had got hurt, I think it turned out that supposedly it was Bobby Jaggers who had ran him off the road, and then you guys, and probably the most violent thing that I've ever seen in wrestling to this day, you guys beat the living hell out of Bobby Jaggers, and I think as they didn't even want to show it on TV, it was so brutal. What can you tell us about the memory of that one where you guys pretty much almost murdered Bobby Jaggers?
Yeah, well, it wasn't murder, mate. Otherwise, you wouldn't be on this planet. But we did a hell of a number on him. You know, Joe Blanchard came out and banned us from wrestling anywhere there too. So I took care of Joe Blanchard at the same time. Hence, the feud started. That started the feud with Tully Blanchard around the whole Northwest. The Northwest. Southwest. Sorry. that started the feud. But Bobby Jaggers, yeah, we opened him up. I came off the corner. I had a coal miner's glove and I broke his arm and I did a bit more than that, put him out for quite some time. He came back and we worked around the country, you know, U.S. against New Zealand, and that flag matches and that, and we did some great business there. The old Southwest of that was a blood and guts territory.
Yeah, there was a lot of guys had a lot of scar tissue on their foreheads, and you wrestled a lot of guys like Manny Fernandez and Carlos Colon, and who were some of your favorite opponents back in Southwest?
A couple of kids who I made a lot of money with was the Fantastics. They weren't big guys, but they had a lot of heart in that. And we started off with normal matches, and then no DQ matches, boot camp matches, cage matches, and we ended up, Bill Watts and UWF built a cage, a barbed wire cage in the end, and we ran around the whole the territory, which was an enormous territory. I think we did 37 barbed wire cage matches back to back. And we did a lot of business there. That territory ran from New Orleans, New Orleans, right up to Oklahoma, and right up to St. Louis, Kansas City, St. Louis. It went from and over to Texas and over and as far as Alabama. That was a big territory, the UWS.
Go ahead, Craig.
You guys wrestled in the Jim Crockett Memorial Tag Team Cup. What was it like getting kind of on a big stage for the first time?
That was the big stage, one of our biggest stages for the first time, and it was a great event. As you know, that was when we went with these two kids, the Fantastics to the semifinals, and we were knocked out, and it was a double DQ. Got out of hand, blood and guts, and we got counted out. We all got counted out, and that put us out of that cup. You know, it was a bit disappointing at the time, but that match has been written up by a lot of people as one of the greatest matches in that era. It was a bloody wild, brawl.
Yeah, I think it even got 5 stars from the Wrestling Observer, and I think it's also probably the most remembered match of that whole tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was as the people still talk to me about that. You know, a few things, when you get on in life and that, a few things come up and that, and people send me on Facebook or different things when they come across matches, and that one they remind me about. And then there was a barbed wire cage match in Puerto Rico with the Invaders, who were in New York for Vince Senior years and years ago. That comes up. And, of course, another thing comes up all the time, the Royal Rumble that I was in the ring for 4 seconds. I marched out and Earthquake grabbed me, took me to the other side, threw me out and landed on my feet. And I just kept on, like an ever-ready batteries, I just kept on ticking right, marching back to the dressing room. People bring that up a lot. And that's 20 years old, that match.
It's old, though.
That is great to think that people remember those. These are sort of things that people remember and bring to my notice all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years and that, you know, another thing is people ask us, how can we go? We were one of the first hardcore tag teams before hardcore was hardcore. You know, till ECW in the early 80s and the late 70s, we were doing barbed wire matches, a lot of cage matches, boot camp matches, 4-way chain matches, coal miner glove on a pole matches from the late 70s or mid to late 70s, right till we went to Vince. And when we, you know, and then all of a sudden we went from that to the entertaining comedy tag team of the Bushwhackers. And a lot of people say to you, how can you change from one thing like that to the other? And the bottom line is, of course, one thing is wrestling, and the other thing is WWF. They sort of put you on the celebrity status. And now merchandising and that, the whole thing is money.
Mm-hmm.
Entertainment, of course. People, you know, if the people farted at it, we wouldn't have done it. But the people loved it. The people bought the Bushwhackers and that. And we became a great, here I am, you know, we were accepted. They accepted our gaga, and they loved us. And I'm still doing that today, believe it or not. From 88, we started the Bushwhackers in 88, and here it is 2011. I never put my boots on from 2002, Butch left me in 2001, and then from then on, I never put my boots on to 2009 or 2008. I was in a wrestling office, booking and that, which I'd been doing all my life, booking talent and territories. But I was in Puerto Rico for IWA, down here, writing television and booking talent and running shows. And then in late 2008, Honky Tonk got injured up in Canada doing a skit with a guitar, and he took his finger off, and he called me up, and he says, I got a month of bookings here, 6 weeks of bookings, can you come and take them for me? And at the time, I finished with the office in Puerto Rico. The owner had died in the end of 2007 and 2008. The business was sort of winding down, and then, so I actually put my boots back on the first time, and hit the road and got that taste of it again.
Couture, go ahead, Couture.
Yeah, one of your former flag bearers has been on TV recently, and Johnny Ace. And I was just wondering, what was it like working with him back in the late 80s, and what do you think about where his career's gone?
Yeah, well, I've known Johnny Ace since he started in the business. His older brother and that was a good friend of mine. The Road Warriors were great friends of mine over the years. I was there when they actually started, and then I was in NWA and that when Johnny came in there, and Dusty put him with us. He says, you learn the business, I'm going to run you with the sheep herders and that as a flag bearer. So Johnny hadn't been in the ring, he had been in a training camp and that, but he came on the road for 2 years with us. And then when we went to WWF and that, sort of that was we parted ways and that, and of course he went on with Shane Douglas, and they worked for about a year in WCW as surfers. I don't know what the gimmick, I think it's their name.
The Dynamic Dudes.
What were they called?
The Dynamic Dudes.
Dynamic Dudes. And then he went to Japan and that, and he got a big break in Japan. And, of course, he kept coming back to the States and that, and he wanted to come back and work in the States, and I kept telling him, run that, hey, while you're in Japan, keep on that run. Don't let it go. And that, you've always got the States later. And then he had a 10-year run in Japan, and he was, in the end, he was one of the top men for Barber, and for Barber's company in Japan. He was actually booking the talent for Barber before Barber died, and then because Barber, you know, and that was one of the main promoters. There's only two major promoters in Japan in all those years in the 90s, and that was Inoki and Barber. And he was in with Barber, and then he had a great run there. And now he's back here, and he's Vince's right-hand man. And now they brought him out from back in the office and put him in on the screen as a general manager.
Mm-hmm. With no personality.
I don't know how this is going to fare on that. Yeah. He's got a lot of booze. We'll see. The ratings are going to see how the ratings are. You know, he's doing the heel. I guess he's doing the heel gimmick. I don't speak to him much. He's so busy up there, you know, so I very rarely speak to him. I speak to him about four times a year now. But before, when he was in Japan and that, we both lived in Florida, you know, about 5 miles apart. And every time he come from home from a tour in Japan. You know, we always got together and that, and I've been down in Puerto Rico since 2002, so I, you know, I very rarely see him.
Now, Jack Beatrice was also a flag bearer of yours. What are your memories of him?
Who's that?
Jack Beatrice.
Jack Beatrice, you're great. You know, he was in our corner in that match in the Superdome in the Crockett Cup. And Jack was a great guy. Funny part is, we've had three major flag bearers over the period of time. It was Johnny Ace, there was Jack Beatrice, and there was Rip Morgan. And later on, Rip Morgan and Jack Beatrice became a tag team in WCW with Little Brook as their manager. You know, Little Brook, the midget?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Lord Littlebrook. And that Rip Morgan is the nephew of my Butch's his uncle.
Oh.
Yeah, a lot
of people didn't know that.
And Kiwi Pro Wrestling. If you go to kpwonline.com down in New Zealand, that's a company in New Zealand that's owned by Rip Morgan. It doesn't run very often than that, but they've got a school and they run in Wellington, it's out of Wellington, New Zealand. That's Rip's company.
Interesting. Now, Liz, you mentioned Puerto Rico a couple of times, and I wanted to ask you, you had wrestled there, of course, before what happened with Bruiser Brody, and you had gone back after. And was that something that was hard to do? Because a lot of guys, a few guys never went back to Puerto Rico after that.
I'm living there now, mate. You're talking to me in Puerto Rico.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've been coming into Puerto Rico since the late 70s, 79 and that, because we did some big business down here. We were doing ballparks of 25,000 people here. In the late 70s, and I used to use Frank. You know, Frank would run with me for a while, and then he'd go over and run with the Bon Erics, then come back and run with us. And that, and down in Puerto Rico, we made a lot of money with Frank and Stan Hansen and Abdullah. You know, because of course they were known for all the blood and gut matches.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like working for Carlos Colon?
Carlos Colon, the first time was very good. I had great years there. I first came in for him in 79, and worked for him a short time then. But then I came back after Texas, and when I was doing I came down here to Puerto Rico for Capital Sports, and I was in the office there for 2 years, running and working there. And I had very, very good financial years for 2 years there. You know, that's when we were running hot and heavy with Brody. That's when I changed Brody from heel to babyface. And it was great. Business was great. I left here in 80, I think I left there 84, 85, around here, and then I went to, that's when I went to Bill Watts then. After I went to Bill Watts, then back to, and then I went back, when Bill Watts was bought out by Crockett, and I went back to Crockett NWA, and then I went to Vince.
Go ahead, Craig.
I was going to ask you, what was it like meeting Vince McMahon when he had asked you guys to come in?
The funny thing is, he's got a little short story here. We're in Cincinnati, and we're working out on a Saturday morning, and I'd finished working out, Butch was doing more cardio. I went out to the phone to pick up and dial my home, pick up my messages in Charlotte, because we were working for NWA at the time, running around the country. We were running around the, you know, the South against the Rock and Roll Express. And I dial up my message, and I hear this voice in that. And I don't know who it was, and they said, this is Pat here. Could you give this number a call? We'd like to talk to you about some business. It didn't dawn on me who Pat was. So I rang, it was a Sunday morning about 11 o'clock. I rang the number, and I went through, and believe it or not, Pat picked up the phone, and it was Pat Patterson. And he said, I'm going to put you on the speakerphone because Vince McMahon's here. Next minute, I was listening to Vince McMahon. And I'd sent tapes in. I'd sent tapes in from WWF from 82 onwards, before it even became WWF. Then this business is the right time, the right place, and they just got rid of a British team, the British Bulldogs. So they were looking for, I guess, another team, you know, from under the British flag, because New Zealand is, you know, under the British flag. And next minute, right, as I said, right time, that he says to us on the phone, the other phone, because you like to, when can you have a day off? And I said, I think we've got a day off next Thursday. He says, when you get home, you'll have tickets. Give me your address. You'll have tickets sitting at home when you get home. Fly up. I'd like to talk to you. And that was it. We flew up to Connecticut, and we went into his office and that. And he says, I'd like to change. You know, what did you guys think of being the good guys? And actually, we're sitting on. He was on one side of his desk, and we were on the other side. And Butch got up, leaned over his desk, and he put his nose. I'd say his nose was about 12 inches. Away from Vizio, he says, if you can make these faces baby faces, go for it. And you know, Vince hasn't got a small nose, but us Kiwis, we got big noses, Butch and me. Anyhow, he says, well, look at my baby faces. They're not the prettiest things. He says, Jake the Snake, Hacksaw Jim Duggan. He says, they're my mate. And Hulk, he says, and he says, they're my baby faces. And he says, look at their faces. You know, so of course I piped up and I said to him, bring us in his heels and turn us to baby faces. He says, no, you can't tell Caesar what to do. He says, no, that's not the way I do it. He says, if you don't mind, I'll bring, if you, when you finish up with the other company, I'll bring you up to do vignettes. And that I'll bring you up for about a month to do vignettes, and then we'll start you on the road. So we went back, handed our notice in, and blah blah. Started doing flying up every week and do two or three vignettes, and that because at the time they weren't only on the network. They were on USA Network then. They just got USA Network. Funny part is I was with Joe Blanchard when I first came in, and we had USA Network, and I didn't realize how powerful it was. I was green to the television industry, like TBS. I made a big F up earlier on with TBS. So when I came into Joe Blanchard, we were on Sid, which was Channel 60. It's a Spanish network, or 61 or 41. It was Sid. It's all over the U.S. was a Spanish network at the time, and we're on USA Network, and I didn't realize how powerful USA Network was. I don't think no one knew how these stations like TBS and USA Network and WGN would blow up like they did, that they became, you know, once you got on those powerful stations, you were made. And anyhow, so we did these vignettes with Vince. And then he says, then they called us up and he says, we want you to start. And I think it was about September or October 2008 by the time that's when we hit the road. I think it was September or October 2008.
Now, when you were making the little videos to introduce you before you actually start wrestling, it was such a far cry from the Sheepherders. Did you ever stop to think to yourself, it was like, did you ever think that it was going to, that you, the Bushwhackers were going to be as big as they were, because more people would now remember you for the Bushwhackers over the Sheepherders, but it was just such a big difference. What were you thinking at the time making the transition?
Well, when Vince said to us, I want you between the Moondogs and the Sheepherders, And that's what he said to us. So when we got home, Butch says to me, well, if you're going to be between, like, the Moondog and Vince Sinners, we're copying other people's gimmicks and that. He says, you know, he said to me, we've got to create something. He says, hey, this can we, we'd heard about the marketing with WWF. We'd heard about how much the Sheik had made in dolls and T-shirts and all that. So we had to come up with a complete, he never came up with a gimmick. We didn't even have the name of the Bushwhackers at the time. And that, you know what I mean? But all of a sudden, a week later, contracts come in the mail, and that all, you know, and it was the, and it had the Bushwhackers on it, and that, you know, and we created the marching. We always, when we're heels, when we went out the ring and that, and we always swung our arms around and screamed whoa and yay and all that, but we never made it into that comical thing that we did when we became the Bushwhackers. Yeah, we marched into the ring with our knees, you know, swinging arms. As Jesse Ventura says, used to say, here comes those marching maniacs from down under. And you know, that's what the people remembered. Who else would, whoever's come to the ring like that, swinging their arms and pumping their legs and grabbing fans by the head and giving them a lick, you know what I mean? I always licked the back of my hand, but, you know, it looked like I was licking people's heads and that, and that was their gimmick, and people always remember that. It was something mm-hmm. that nobody else has done, nobody else had done, and nobody else has copied since then.
I'm
sure. Yeah, back in, I believe it was the year 2000, you wrestled on the pay-per-view called the Heroes of Wrestling against the Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov. What do you remember about that match and that show?
That was, you're talking about an independent one?
Yeah, it was a small one, I think, in Mississippi or something, pay-per-view.
That was about 2007. Yeah, that was a year... That was the year we came out of Vince. It was late 2006 or 2007, but that's when we worked in that hole. That was God bless them. I love them. I love the both of them. But that match was not something I like to talk about. If you watch that match, those two, none of them got out of the ring when it was time. You know how a tag match, one of you always stands outside the ring on the corner. You know, in a tag match. There's always two inside the ropes and two outside the ropes on opposite corners, right? If you notice them, there's one in the ring. There's two of them in the ring all the time. They were too lazy to get outside the ring. One stood inside the ring in the corner. It's not something I'm. That's one match I'm not proud, you know, not proud to talk about. And I love them, you know, the Sheik when Butch first left me in 82 or something or other, I had the Iron Sheik as my partner for about 3 months. I got him in San Antonio, in that Texas territory. I borrowed him off WTBF, and we tagged for about 6 or 8 weeks around the territory. So but that's when the Sheik was in the early days. I know. I've known Kazro since 1979, 1980, when I first went to NWA in the Carolinas.
Now, you actually started your career in New Zealand, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that territory, because you know, a lot of people in the United States, I guess, really don't know too much about New Zealand.
No, New Zealand. Yeah, short little story. New Zealand's two islands, 600 long by 150 wide. And then when I first started down there, and it was scary, but I'm going to tell you what year I started, 1962. And then it was two matches a night, amateur wrestling would be to intermission. And then after that, there was an 8 5-minute round, a light heavyweight, and then a heavyweight with the 8 8-minute rounds. And there was four ropes. and I was a light heavyweight at the time. I was around 175 pounds at Sweet William. I worked as a fag gimmick. I had a valet, and I had long blonde hair and curlers. If you go to my website, you may see some photos there from the early 60s. Bushwhackerluke.net or .com. Anyhow, I worked with Sweet William there, and Butch, he was still playing rugby, you know, which is a great sport. It's just, it's like gridiron, but if people know what rugby is, it's football, but New Zealand playing, the World Cup's in New Zealand at the moment, anyhow. But Butch was playing football, and he didn't start playing wrestling till 67. And we teamed up, and that in 68, 67 when he started, and then we first went away together in 69. I was going to Australia and working for an American promoter called Jim Barnett in the 60s, and Sweet William, and I'd go over there, 66, you know, for 2 or 3 weeks. That's when they had all the big stars. Jim Barnett was the first guy to bring American wrestling down under to Australia. And that was Australia was running 7 days a week in that. In New Zealand, we were only running in the early 60s. And when I was working, we'd only run when they brought an American or a European wrestler into the country. Someone would come into the country for 3 months and that, and the promoter would run 3 or 4 towns a week and that, and so that's when we'd go on the road. And when there was no overseas talent there, we'd only run maybe once a month in the capital city, or, you know, you could fly anywhere in New Zealand and be home. You know, I could fly from Wellington, which is the capital, anywhere in the country. I could be up north in Auckland, which is the biggest city, in an hour, or I could be down the South Island and back home in an hour on a plane, you know. So it was, New Zealand is the southern part, Wellington is the southern part of the North Island, which is the capital. That's where I'm from, me and Butch are from. And Butch is back there now. He left me in 2002, as I said before, and he's living back there now. So, but that, New Zealand never started running for full time till 67. And that's when it started running, 66, started running full time around the country. And that a guy called John De Silva, who had been in the Empire Games, which is the British equivalent to the Olympic Games, he came back after winning a medal. He turned pro. And opened up running full time. And then in the early 70s, Jim Barnett came over from Australia and helped the New Zealand promoter too. So it really got running then. And in 74, Butch and me came over here to the States late 71 the first time, and or North America. And we went home at the end of 74, 75, when we first did the first television wrestling called On the Mat in New Zealand. We the promoter brought us back to New Zealand then, and we did the first series of wrestling on television in New Zealand.
Now, you mentioned Jim Barnett. He was a very, very important person in the wrestling business in that time period. What were your thoughts on working for him?
Well, he was a brilliant man. Even though he was, everybody knows he was gay, and God bless him, but he was brilliant. You gotta thank him for getting television wrestling on the satellite. He's the one that got Ted Turner to put it up. You know, the WCW World Championship Wrestling. It was WTBS at the start. You know, when they first had Tommy Rich, and then they had Rick Martel. And Tommy Rich was more or less the first golden boy of wrestling on the satellite television. And then Rick Martel and him were the tag partners in that TBS. Jim Barnett was the first to have coast to coast wrestling. From from Chicago over to the East Coast, Maryland, right over to the West Coast. He's the one that hooked it all up. Morris and help the business survive to get where it is. You know, he had his finger in Florida Championship Wrestling. He had his finger everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Now, very early on, you worked for Stampede Wrestling. And what was it like working in Stampede and working for Stu Hart?
The first territory I came into the North America work for was in Grand Prix. And that was in, that was out of Montreal. Let me tell you how we got into Stampede, mate. We came into Grand Prix. The Vachons, Morris Vachon and Butcher Vachon are the guys that brought us over to this side of the world. And we'd known Andre the Giant, and they just brought an Andre into North America, into Quebec, and we came in about 3 months after, and we knew Andre. And at the time, the territory was Quebec and Ontario, and a bit of Manitoba. They had it on fire. It was called Grand Prix Wrestling, and we didn't know. We were there, and we didn't know until I had a meeting in the office that they were running three towns a night. We thought we were the only town they were running. When they had the meeting, we saw all the people they had there. The names at the time was phenomenal. The talent they had in the territory, you know, and the talent flying in and out, you know, like Bruno Sammartino. Killer Kowalski was the main heel at the time, you know, and we'd known him from Australia too. He was Jim Barnett's big star that got Australia on fire. Anyhow, we finished with the Grand Prix. We worked for them for a year and a half, and they sent us over to. They said, you know, from here we're sending you over to Stampede Wrestling. We didn't, and they said the guy that owns it is Stu Hart. We didn't know of Stu Hart, who he was or what he was. We didn't know about the dungeon, nothing and that. And the 12 kids. The first night we were there, we're working in the pavilion on a Friday night. That's in the fairgrounds. There's two arenas. There, at the time, there was the pavilion, which was worked every Friday night, and about six times a year, they'd work the corral, which is at the same fairgrounds. The pavilion holds about 3,000, 4,000, and the corral holds about 8,000. That weekend, the weekend we started, they were running the TVs every Friday night, which is show on Sunday morning. And then they're running that corral on the Sunday. And now we were in the ring that night working against the champions, and we got disqualified. And we're beating up the champions with the old flagpole and a little bit of blood and guts, doing what we do best, creating a little havoc. Next minute, all these kids were getting thrown in the ring by Abdullah. Abdullah was in the territory, and some of them were bleeding and that. These kids were 11, 12, 13, maybe 10. To about 40 years of age. We didn't know whose kids they were. Abdullah was feeding them and throwing them in the ring to us and screaming at us, beat them up, beat them up. And we were kicking the shit out of them and doing what we do, you know what I mean, beating them up. Anyhow, then we left all the bodies laying in the ring, and he called us out, Abdullah called us out, and we followed them back to the dressing room. And this was nothing set up or anything. And then we got back to the dressing room, and Stu called us, what the bloody hell are you doing? And he said, what are you bloody hell are you doing? They're my kids. And we said, Abby said to us in the ring. And they said, Abby told us to beat them up. Yeah, that was shown on television the next morning. When we came out on the corral on Sunday, we were hot. We had people throwing shit at us. We were hot. We were hot. That was the quickest time we ever got hot going into the territory.
Awesome.
Usually we used to go into a territory with the New Zealand flag, and as we told you before, we always got American to carry the New Zealand flag, because that really pissed the Americans off, getting one of their own and getting them to side with us and saying to them that they were proud to carry our flag. That really pissed Americans off. And we would go into a territory, beat the local kids up in the territory for about 4 weeks on television. Then we used to take a map of the state we're in and do a promo in the toilet, you know, an interview, promo in the toilet, with the map of the state, and we used to push it down the toilet down the shitter with the New Zealand flagpole, and then hold the flag over the toilet and say, that's where the state belongs. It's a shithole the state's a shithole. And by then, that's when we used to get the people cutting our tires, smashing our... In the old days, they used to cut the tires of our cars, smash our windscreens and, you know, the windshields and all that sort of stuff on the car. Many times we'd come out of arenas and the tire, all the cars were on the rims and the windshield, well, the back window was knocked out. So those were the good old days. We knew by then, you know, when we come out and saw that, we knew that the people were mad and we just needed the opponents to work against and the arenas were going to be full. And that's how it worked. Well, many times we had to get out of arenas. I can tell you a lot of stories getting out of arenas where police cars had to come and put us in the police cars, and we had to get someone else to drive our car away from the arena because the fans didn't know which was our car, and meet us outskirts of town. You know, when we did in the territorial days where you drove to a town every night, you know how there was years ago there was 25 territories in North America, that's counting Canada, and that, and you work 7 days a week, and we had to get driven out of the arenas in squad cars and taken away. We used to get a lot of, especially in the South, you know, where the people believe that it was wild. Anyhow, even up in the Northwest, you know, and when I was working up there, we had a lot of riots there. We had a long run with Piper and Martel up in the Northwest, for Don Owens.
How did you like working for Don Owens and that time period in Portland?
Oh, that was a great territory, mate. Short trips home every night. You know, we would now and again we would be away for, you know, spend a night in a hotel. You're home, you'd be leaving home about 4 or 5 every night. So you spend most of your time at home, and then drive to the town, work the town, and be home the same night. Different than when you're working down south for the Crockett's. It's like you're leaving. We were working for NWA, and then we're working for UWF. So what? You know, we'd be leaving home about 1 o'clock every afternoon. Some trips are 300 miles. To the town, work the town 300 miles home, and you'd be flying 1 or 2 days a week. You know, those you're burnt out. You had to try and get to the gym. You'd be getting home 4 in the morning. You'd sleep to about 4. You'd sleep to about 9 or 10. Get an hour in the gym. The next minute, you're in the car driving to the bloody town. Every day, that was hard. Don Owens wasn't the big money like those other territories I'm talking about, but we had great talent there. We had, everybody was in that territory, mate, ended up working, you know, that we worked with. Most of them worked for Vince McMahon, you know, Cowboy Ron Bass, Jesse Ventura, Rick Martel, Roddy Piper, what's his name? The blonde-headed guy, Jesus. He was our general in our army, Buddy Rose, and then you had Edward Scalzi. Everybody was great talent there. Great talent.
Now, I know it wasn't Don Owens, but I think it might have been his brother or someone used to pay the wrestlers to. He thought they would to shoot on each other in the match, but the boys would always work it. Did you ever take part in any of those?
Elton, you talking about Don's brother, Elton?
Yes.
No, Elton. The 1 minute shoots at the start of the match. That was a funny thing, mate. When my partner and me walked in the dressing room the first time for Elton Owens, he looked at my partner, Butch, and Butch had a big chest. You know, when the old days, he wasn't like in WWF. He was big and bulky and big arms and that. And Elton looked at me and says, well, you look like you've been to college. You know, we didn't have wrestling in college in those days, mate. You had wrestling in clubs in New Zealand. Butch was a rugby player. Anyhow, he looked at that and he says, can you shoot a bit to Butch? Butch says, shit, I went out. He says, yeah, I started shooting when I was 7. All right. And he says, you did? And Elton got excited. And then, and he says, what do you, who you, he mentioned any names. And he says, what do you mean by names? Butch says, oh, I was going out with my father. Animal shooting, you know, hunting, shooting. And Elton said, Elton come to me later that night. And he says, your partner's got a bad attitude. He thought shooting, Butch thought he was talking about, we didn't know that he was having 1 minute shoots. Elton had a little trophy in the dressing room, and he used to have these 1 minute shoots, especially when the boys come to the territory and they had an amateur background. He would have them in the ring doing a 1 minute shoot or 2 minute shoot, then the referee would tap them on the shoulders, and then they'd change from amateur to professional. We didn't even know that what was going on at the start until we saw what was going on. That was unreal. Elton was a crazy old, God bless him, Elton was a crazy old bastard. We made big money. We made good money, good money in the northern end, but in the southern end, we didn't make so much. That was the end of Elton run. Elton didn't have any idea what was going on in the business. He was a drunk, and then he had his minute shoots, and he used to have to ring up with and ask. He lived on the same piece of land that his brother did, and his brother ran the television every Saturday. He didn't even know who his champions were. Come Monday or Tuesday, when we worked for Elton every week, he'd have to ask us, who's the champions this week? He wouldn't even know. He wouldn't even watch the TV to find out who the champions were.
Couture, go ahead, Couture.
Yeah, what was it like to come back in 2001 for the gimmick battle royal at WrestleMania 17 in the Astrodome in Houston?
Oh, that was great, mate. That was great. Vince wanted us to come and do the Fan Fest that weekend, but we were already booked well in advance, you know, 6 months out, and we flew in on Sunday from Sacramento or somewhere, and we were tired, but we were the first out of the curtains in that match, and I guess because they wanted to open up with two crazy guys walking out, we walked out and that, with it was back in the WWF. We hadn't been in such a big crowd like that since 96, 97, and we walked out, and I think there was about 70,000 there. That was in the Astrodome or whatever it was, the building in Houston, Texas.
Yes,
marched out on that and blah blah blah. I know the match didn't get some very good raves in the end because they put the Sheik over in the end and the people didn't sort of like that.
I was actually there live for that show, and yeah, I very much enjoyed that battle royal and seeing everybody coming out.
Yeah, seeing all the old favorites again. It was great to be there, mate. Yeah. You know, there's a few things you remember in life, too. And one of my greatest memories, you know, that was great to come back for. One of my greatest memories was, too, walking out at the last show they ever had in Wembley Stadium, the old Wembley Stadium in London. There was 94,000 people there. And it was Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Butch and me. And I always remember, I can never remember matches when people tell me about, but I can always remember who was in this match. Hacksaw, Butch and me against the Mountie and the Nasty Boys. And they were already in the ring. When we marched out in front of that crowd and heard those people there, it was electrifying. 94,000 people screaming. You can imagine what that was like. And there was Hacksaw Duggan doing this, whoa, and there was Butch doing the whoa, and me doing the yay. So we had a hell of a musical threesome.
Now, what are some of your other favorite memories from the WWE?
The two greatest memories, you know, that comes to mind is the other time when I first walked out into the Madison Square Garden, but this time I'm in a battle royal and I'm in the ring, and when Hulk walks out to that ring in the battle royal, this was something, the aura for a start and the fever pitch there, it was something, this was in the late 80s, I think, or maybe the early 90s. And that's when Hulkamania was running wild. And the noise there, I think my hair stood on my arms. That's how, you know, they've had The Rock and they've had, and you know, I love The Rock and Stone Cold. But I don't think the fever pitch has ever been as it was then, you know, to that extent when he came out in the gardens and when that Hulkamania was running wild. It was unbelievable, the noise. You couldn't talk in the ring. You couldn't, no one, it was just so fever pitch. It was deafening.
Craig, go ahead, Craig.
I was wondering what you thought of filming the episode of Family Matters with Steve Urkel.
Yeah. You know, they still play that on some of the other channels. You know, the other, you know, cable channels, that now and again.
Yeah.
I late at night, I see that thing. That was another part of my life, that going to Burbank and working with those guys, that was a great, you know, I worked a few things. We worked Personality Squares, and I worked on Fox Network, you know, for underprivileged kids with a lot of different stars, and that Sweet Pea, you know, Pernell Whitaker, and the guy that played a football player, a running back who had the liver transplant, was wanting to have a liver transplant, but he died. I forget his name. Beautiful guy. Forget his name. I worked on a lot of shows with him, but working with those, but working and Family Matters with these was one of the highlights of my life. You know, that the guy, the main actor in that, he was great. And the next door neighbor, the cop, what's his name now? He's worked in a lot of, he worked in some Mel Gibson movies too.
Right. And the name totally escapes me.
Danny Glover?
No.
I think he meant
Die
cop.
Hard movie. With Bruce Willis?
Yeah, no, the guy next door.
I know, okay.
You know what? The next door, Steve Urkel's neighbor. He's a policeman.
Yes.
In Family Matters. And that the
right.
whole cast was great. You know, they were wrestling fans. So the Steve and all that, they were hooked in wrestling at the time. And that, and in Burbank, even when we were out of the ring and that, the ring was there, they were jumping in the ring and jumping around. Well, they were young anyhow, too, at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was cool. We had a great time. We were there for a week, and it was great.
Now, I think the last few years you've been doing some work with Ring of Honor. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, the Ring of Honor. Well, when Honky hit his finger at that time era, and he called me up and he said, oh, and I want you to come and work some matches for me. At that time, I was up in New York with a friend, Kerry Silkin, who owned the Ring of Honor at the time, is a good friend of mine before he even got into the wrestling business. And I was up in New York with him, and that night, one night he says to me, why don't you go out there? He says, you know, our champion at the time was the guy from the West Coast.
Daniels?
Oh, boy, I forget his name now.
Samoa Joe?
Huh?
Samoa Joe?
No, it was after that. Anyhow, I went out and then we did a little skit of that, and when I came marching out and did this little skit with them, I heard the people, and they all started cheering at that. And I actually, believe it or not, I didn't realize how strong that 24/7 was at the time, because a lot of the people were chanting for the sheep herders. You know, the crowd for ROH is the old, like an ECW crowd, you know, a real live chanting crowd, and that, and there was a lot of them. They were chanting, you know, sheep herders. Even though I was doing the bushwhacking gimmick, I got a lot of people chanting for the sheep herders. But after that, I worked a lot of shows for them. I worked a lot of WrestleMania shows where they usually run on a Friday night and a Saturday afternoon, the weekend of WrestleMania and that. And I worked in different places in Toronto, Chicago, in Nashville. I worked a lot of places with them.
I was about to say that me and Craig saw you work Riptitus in Houston a couple years ago, and that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was about 3 or 4 years ago, the WrestleMania there. I was with them. I was there in the afternoon. I worked for them.
I actually sat next
that was,
to you.
That was when Booker T, that's when actually Booker T was downstairs, and he had a big autograph session Friday night and Saturday morning of WrestleMania. And we were upstairs.
Correct.
And then on the other floor running the shows.
Right. I actually got to sit next to you in Orlando. We were, I was on the back row on the floor, and I pulled up my seat, and there's Bushwhacker Luke sitting right to my left.
Well, did I give you a licking, mate?
Not as I can remember.
No, you kind of taste, you kind of smell like sardines. If you did, I would have given you a good licking.
Nowadays, you talked about how the early chanting sheep herders. When you go to these shows, do you find more people talk to you about you being a bushwhacker, or do more people talk to you about being a sheep herder?
I know they talk to me about Andy's autograph sessions and the conventions. I get a lot of sheep herder fans. You know, I wish you were still the sheep herder. Why did you change and all that? You know, I get that. But most of, you know, that era now, you're going back to the 70s and 80s. You know, we're 90s and that's 20, let's go back 20 years of that. And a lot of them don't read, these kids today, they don't know about that. Unless they watch 24/7, you know, WWF. You know, I heard last month in September, they played a lot of the sheep herder stuff. On the 24/7, I haven't got 24/7 TV here, but I just hear it from people.
Now, you've been with us for quite a bit, so we'll go ahead and start to wrap up, and we'll all get our last questions. Craig, go ahead and ask your last question.
I'm just gonna give you a chance. You have the website, ButchWilliams.com.
Yes, mate. I've got a website. I've got bushwhackerluke.net or .com. And I've got on my Facebook page, it's Bushwhacker Luke Williams. And I have an official Facebook page too, which is, people are welcome to go and join them up.
And do you have anything upcoming, live events or autograph signings or anything like that?
I've got upcoming. I've got my next upcoming events are at the end of this, at the end of this month. This is the slowest month I've had. Last month I worked 16 times. Unbelievable,
wow.
Isn't it? And then I've had a busy summer. You know, I was away. I was actually away from home for 3 weeks in July doing fairs. I don't really work around the South much, but I worked around Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi. And then I was doing a lot of fairs and carnivals. Fairs and little Saturday night shows, every Friday night shows, and fairs during the week there. But end of this month, I'm working in Oshawa, and I'm working in another town. And then coming next month, I'm on the road again. Coming next month, if you go to my site and Facebook page, no, I haven't put the towns up yet, but they're in the States. I'm in the States, in Chicago, I'm in Ontario, Canada, and I'm in, I can't remember now, I'm in a few places, and I'm in Texas. I haven't even looked, mate, but I know that next November, I've got about 12 events. And I'm in Austin too for the Wizard World's Comic Con for the 17th, 18th, and 19th. The 10th, 11th, and 12th of November, I'm in the Wizard World in Austin, Texas.
Katrina, go ahead and answer that question.
What was it like working with Jameson?
There was an oddball, and I just saw him too. I never actually saw him, but I saw him advertised at a convention, a Wrestling Legends convention in New Jersey 2 weeks ago. I heard that Vince picked him up out of Broadway. Vince was at a show in Broadway and he was an extra doing a little bit part on a show there, and he saw him as a character, and he threw him with us. And I have a lot of people often ask me, what happened to Jameson? You know, people sort of bought that stint. He was the sort of guy that they put him on. He never went on the road with us much. He did Madison Square Garden, the television every Monday night, and pay-per-views. And he was with us for about 6 months, and the people bought that. That little nerd with the glasses. and I think, too, that's where the Dudley boys sort of got that sort of glass. You know, their spectacle with a bit of tape in the middle. That's where they picked that up, too.
Now, Bush, for my last question before we let you go is going back to San Antonio. I know it's been a very, very, very long time, but do you have any favorite Mexican restaurants or places to hang out that you remember fondly here from San Antonio?
Well, mate, that's so long ago, I can't remember the places. But it was a beautiful city to live in, the Riverwalk. I loved it there, you know, with the Riverwalk and that. It was very dangerous going out, though. At the time, we couldn't actually go out and party much or go to any of the bars because people were wanting to kill us, you know what I mean? It was, you know, Austin that many times, getting out of Austin, you know, the rednecks with the pickup trucks and the old rifle, the gun rack in the back. You know, we getting out of some of the arenas in Texas was pretty dangerous. We were a hot item there. We had a great tag team to work with. God bless one of them, but Dickie Murdoch, who's passed, and Manny Fernandez. You know, there's a good old redneck Dickie Murdoch and a Mexican, and we had a long run with those two right through there, made some great money. You know, it's pulled some readers there for quite some time.
Well, Liz, like I say, it's actually been an honor for me to talk to you. I mean, like I say, I grew up watching you. You terrified me as a little kid, and you entertained me as a teenager in the WWE. And I want to thank you so much for taking so much of your time to talk to us for tonight.
Well, it's been great talking with you guys, and I hope to see you around, mate. And that's when I'll give you a good bushwhacker licking, and I'll save the kicking, for my opponent.
Cool. Well, you have a good night, sir.
Okay, then. I got one thing to say to my fans out there. Whoa, yay. Love you guys.
Thank you, Luke.
Thank you. Well, I think that went very, very well. That was very, very entertaining. And it was an easy interview.
Yeah. Yeah, I was worried about it at first, but he got into it. Yeah, he's a fun guy. At 63.
I mean, I love interviews like that because he, you know, we don't hear that today to get him to tell stories. I mean, he basically answered all of my questions within the next first five minutes. So I mean, I thought that was great, and then just talking about just such a wide variety of stuff. I mean, I thought that was really cool.
You know, I bet they loved it when they got to be babyface when they came to WWF anyway, because I bet their bodies were hurting a lot, and that kind of probably slowed them down a little bit. They didn't have to juice anymore. If you never see the Bushwhackers juice, Bushwhackers can't bleed. know?
Yeah, Sheepherders can bleed, but Bushwhackers cannot.
And they were in the good spot. I mean, you know, for the, you know, they were the comedy deal. You know, kind of like a Santino or somebody like that. That's actually a pretty good spot to be in that company. So.
Yeah, because they were always on TV. I mean, you know, they very rarely won, but they didn't need to. I mean, like the Royal Rumble. He was so over walking to the ring, gets thrown out in, what, 2 seconds, goes back to his march, and he's just as over as he was, if not more, because of it. I mean, you can't ask for a better spot than that. I mean, they were and you know, people kind of joke about the Bushwhackers, you know, how, you know, because they very, very kid-friendly or whatever, but, I mean, they got that gimmick over big time. I mean, who wasn't waving their arms in the air, you know? When they came out in that Houston WrestleMania Battle Royal, I'll be the first one to admit that I was one of the first people to jump up out of my seat and start doing my Bushwhackers march. You know, I mean, you know, they were awesome.
I was just amazed they got over. Kind of, well, I was younger that time. I was amazed they got over as baby faces like they did. I mean, you got these two ugly guys, you know, the tattoos, and both of them look just about exactly alike. So,
it was just such a shock. I mean, a lot of people, I remember them from, you know, Crockett for a little bit and Mid-South for a little bit. And, you know, they did the barbed wire cage matches, but they pretty much worked those matches pretty safe. I mean, there was a lot of juice, but no one was getting,
you
know what I mean?
No one was falling off the cage or anything like that.
Yeah, it was nothing bad, but, like, when they were here in San Antonio, and just San Antonio in general was, like, everyone thinks ECW invented hardcore wrestling, which is so absurd because it's been around forever. Memphis was, you know, had hardcore.
And San Antonio, Mid-South, you know, all that stuff.
Mid-South. But San Antonio especially, because if you look at San Antonio and you look at the guys who wrestled in San Antonio, maybe Puerto Rico, but there's no territory that had as much scar tissue as San Antonio. I mean,
oh God, no.
At one point, the top babyface is Bruiser Bob Sweetan. You know, you had Bruiser Bob Sweetan, you had the Sheepherders, you had Brody In and Out, you had Abdullah In and Out, you had Carlos Colon In and Out, you had Manny Fernandez, you had Bobby Jaggers, you know, you had Wahoo, but Wahoo used to come in all the time when he was still in his prime, and you know, you had a young Gil Hernandez and Tully Blanchard. I mean, it was just a crazy, crazy territory, and it just sucks that Joe Blanchard was a horrible businessman, and he basically just didn't take advantage of what he had and didn't run it right, because at one point they had the second strongest channel out there, and they kind of let the pig shit get them banned off the channel and stuff. And
they were on USA, and then USA got dropped in, picked up WWF, and you know, that's really what helped set WWF off.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they were the very first territory to be knocked off the PWI top 10 list, you know, in the back. I mean, it went downhill very fast. They were one of the first territories to die, but it was an exciting time back then for a few years and stuff. I mean, I really had some big memories of, you know, Sheepherders, Ivan Putski, Scott Casey, Walter McDaniels, you know, Tully Blanchard. I mean, Tully Blanchard, when he was just about almost a rookie, basically, I mean, just seeing the potential right there. And I remember they worked a program with Georgia where they kind of like we're doing co-shows, and they'd bring in Stan Hansen, and they'd bring in Larry Zbysko, and they'd bring in Tommy Rich, and, you know, they brought Tommy Rich and Buzz Sawyer to San Antonio. I actually got this. I mean, fans today have no idea what the hell I'm talking about, but, you know, the most famous feud in wrestling is the Von Erich Krieger feud. The second most, well, probably not famous one now, but at the time, for a lot of years, was Tommy Rich, Buzz Sawyer. And I got to see Tommy Rich and Buzz Sawyer blade each other like crazy and bleed all over the arena. I mean, that was a big highlight back in the day, because Tommy Rich was the top babyface. Buzz Sawyer was almost the top heel at the time. You know, they were on fire in Georgia, and for them to actually come to San Antonio, that was pretty cool. And this interview brought back a lot of memories.
Yes, sir. So we got about 10 minutes left. Do we want to do some news, or do you just want to can it for tonight and wrap it up a bit early?
This is some news. I went through a lot of trouble putting it together.
Wait, what was that, sir?
I said I went through a lot of trouble putting it together.
Yeah, that kind of pasting.
It is hard to copy and paste, but we can do a couple things off of there.
Okay, let's see. Our first news story, Jim Ross fired as commentator on Raw in Oklahoma City on the weekend of his anniversary, by the way. After John Laurinaitis was named GM of Raw, he invited JR into the ring and fired him as an announcer. He was interviewed later by Yahoo Sports Radio, and when the angle was brought up, Ross stated he had no idea it was coming.
I don't know. You know, let me go first. This is such fucking bullshit. You know what I mean? You have the world's greatest announcer of all fucking time, Jim Ross, who doesn't have to do it. He's got enough money. He doesn't need to do it. He just loves the business, and he knows that everybody loves him. And he actually made the broadcast decent for the time that he was there. And it's just something that seems to happen like once a year, twice a year. Vince McMahon has to do something to humiliate Jim Ross. I mean, maybe three people knew about this going in. You had Jim Ross's wife in the front row behind the announcers. You had the hometown people. And they pulled this because Vince wants to get his jollies and get a laugh. Well, Vince, I hope you did get a – I hope you got a good laugh, because all you're doing is causing thousands of people from buying your pay-per-views, because, you know, the pay-per-views are down and Jim Ross could single-handedly add buys just by his announcing a week before, a big angle and make it important. And Jim Ross actually could add to the pay-per-views. And now that's gone. Now you got you got Michael Cole going crazy. You got Jerry Lawler not caring. Jerry Lawler doesn't need a fucking this job. Jerry Lawler should have fucking got up out of his fucking chair, because this wasn't scripted. Well, he should have done his own non-scripted thing, and he should have got out, and he should have walked out with Jim Ross and said, fuck you to Vince McMahon, and let's go out there and do it by his goddamn self.
That wouldn't have happened, number one.
It should have happened. Jerry doesn't care. He walked out before. He should have done it again.
Well, since he's been back, JR's only worked like one pay-per-view. He wasn't part of the team, really, on the pay-per-views. I mean, he was on that Hell in a Cell show, but that was just like one show. You know, they just had Booker T in there with Lawler and Cole, so.
They should have left Cole by himself on Raw. I mean, the whole thing was bullshit. The whole thing was pure hatred, bullshit. One day, Vince McMahon, he's the greatest promoter ever. He's done so much stuff to entertain me. But one day, when he's no longer on this earth, he's going to have to answer to a lot of shit. And, you know, he might not like the outcome, you know, when that happens. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. I don't know. Another thing that bothers me about it is, you know, they keep doing this stuff to Jim Ross, and Jim Ross has a condition that doesn't need any stress.
It's You're
like
right.
Even extra scuzzy the way they do that, you know, with the Bell's palsy and stuff. Because they could be triggered just by anything, any kind of stress. So,
right.
I don't know why you want to do that to people. That's appreciate.
I don't understand.
I don't know if Jim Ross is probably well off with money, but you know it never hurts to still have this steady paycheck coming in. You know, just for your future and everything like that. You can always make more money. I mean, you can always use more money. I mean, so I don't blame him for staying if that's what he wants to do. At this point, I think that he doesn't really care that much. He just kind of shrugs his shoulders and goes back to what he's doing and, you know, whatever.
You know, like, that's the thing. The one good thing about this is is Jim Ross actually won this time? You know, he came back. Vince had Cole in his, he was in Cole's ear. Say this, say that, say this. Write him this way, do that. He never sold it. He sold it the whole time. Just kept calling the match, kept doing his thing. You know, and then they call him in to fire him because they want to humiliate him, and old Jim Ross just taps his hat down, goes out, takes the King's hand, and walks out of there with his dignity, something that, unfortunately, right now, Kevin Dunn and Vince McMahon, in my opinion, don't have.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in the end, the person, at this point, the person that always ends up being embarrassed is Vince, because he's the one that comes off as the biggest asshole when this stuff happens. I mean, I don't think Jim Ross feel bad at all, to be honest.
No, totally. Yeah. I just can't believe people that he is that heartless to keep toying with somebody's emotions, and it's just a real D move. And on, you know what I mean?
Just basically, you know, when he has the Bell's palsy, and I mean, we've seen that over the years. You know, like what can trigger that? You know, like when his mother died, that's what triggered his, one of his things of Bell's palsy or something like that. You know, it's just, I don't know why you do that to somebody. It's just like, and it makes these fucking anti-bully ads even worse.
Right. It's just cruel.
It's stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Our next one.
Oh, it's just one of those things that just kind of makes me embarrassed to be a wrestling fan at times. But real quick, everyone check out AngryMarks.com. You can always download and stream our show at AngryMarks.com along with a lot of other shows.
Our next story comes from the good old South. On Tuesday morning, former WWE and TNA wrestler Travis Tomko was arrested in St. John's County, Florida on felony robbery. According to police reports, he was arrested in the bathroom of a Chili's restaurant in St. Augustine, Florida, yesterday after allegedly stealing the painkiller oxycodone from a nearby PVS pharmacy. Tomko allegedly threatened the pharmacist working at the PVS location until he was given the painkiller. He then went to a nearby Chili's where he allegedly asked a person for a spoon and went to the men's bathroom. Tomko was in the restroom upwards of 30 minutes, which cost the police to be called. When they found him in the restroom, he was observed to having had a needle marks in his arm and fresh blood dripping from his arm. So the belief is that he was actually injecting the painkillers. Tomko was allegedly flushed whatever he hadn't used before the police arrived. Apparently the spoon did not make it down. Tomko was said to have made off with 200 pills and used 178 of them
in the bathroom.
He melted them and injected them into his arm. Tomko is still being held on bail at $7,500.
He did that in 30 minutes.
How this man is still alive is just beyond me. I mean, one of those pills will make you feel pretty damn good. And he shot up over 100 of them in, 30 minutes or so? I mean, to the point where there's blood coming out of his arm? I mean, he's lucky. It almost seems like it was a suicide attempt in some ways, because it's almost unfathomable that he survived this. And it's just so sad that, you know, he's just another bad example of what can happen in the pro wrestling business. I mean, the guy had a few years in WWE, had a little run in TNA. You know, never famous or anything, but, you know, still he was making good money. He's doing all right, having notoriety, and now he's reduced to stealing medication from pharmacies, and you know, I mean, I don't know, man. I mean, maybe this is a cry for help. Maybe he wants help, and maybe this is his cry, and maybe this will lead to him getting cleaned up. But, you know,
just
it, honestly,
he
did rock
bottom. I mean, that's just like the depth of everything when you're in the bathroom in Chili's injecting like 178 crushed pills, you know.
That,
I don't know. That's just like a cry for help to me.
It's crazy to think that you can do that much Oxycontin oxycodone, excuse me.
Well, you know, you can build up a tolerance for it, and you can, I mean, I'm sure you've heard guys taking like 50 somas or something like that, you know, taking like 50 somas. But sometimes, you know, you build up that tolerance, but, you know, sometimes that tolerance can, you know, on a certain day, that tolerance cannot be there, so you take way too many, and then, you know, you're just dead. So, you know, playing with your own lives, doing that shit.
Yeah, it's sad. I hope he takes WWE up on the rehab offer.
I remember when he was barely over in TNA, wasn't he? At one time.
Yeah.
Somewhat. Yeah. He was a pretty big star in TNA. He was like they were like pushing him pretty well, and then I don't know. I think they got pissed at him for going to Japan or something like that.
You know, I sat across a restaurant from Tyson Tomko at one time. Oddly enough, he was sitting with Tajiri, Shelton Benjamin, and the deceased Chris Benoit.
I remember he was in the musical chair skit, seeing Jericho with the last two guys.
Oh, yeah.
The music ended, so Jericho just folded the chair up and hit him in the head with it, and they folded it back down and sat down on one. That was awesome.
Yeah, that was pretty great. But I don't know, man. I hadn't heard
anything from him in like at least 2 or 3 years. So
not since he had that like tryout or almost went back to WWE, and that was about it. But
I just figured maybe he'd gone back to Japan or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's the size that the Japanese people like,
and he's a guy that probably works good in Japan. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of what I was alluding to. Did you guys read the story on Lagana?
Yeah, I did see that.
He just promised me he's going to get Dixie Carter on the show.
I actually, he messaged me on Monday, and he said, can you keep a secret? And I'm like, no. and he spilled the story, and he didn't go into massive detail like he did today, but yeah. He's going to be working for TNA, but not really for TNA. So
it's going to be they're trying to launch a wrestling brand in India, from what I've heard. And I think he and Jeff Jarrett and I think Dutch Mantel are involved in you know getting the thing started. So that's interesting. I know that Sanjay Dutt and BG James went to India like last week to scout for some talent or something like that. It's not going to have the TNA name, I don't think. But,
right.
You know, it'll be a TNA brand.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly the name of the brand just offhand. But, good on Dave. He's actually making the move over to Nashville. And just wish him the best of luck if he'll ever even hear this.
So no more interviews.
And I'm chatting with him right now, actually.
Yeah, he's on Facebook right now. Anyway, yeah, so speaking of TNA, there's a big Bound for Glory pay-per-view this Sunday, and actually kind of looking forward to it. AJ Styles versus Christopher Daniels in an I Quit match.
Why not?
We got Samoa Joe versus Crimson versus Matt Morgan. We got TNA Knockouts Champion Winter versus Mickey James versus Velvet Sky versus Mattis Brain. The TNA Tag Champions Mexican America versus the newly Tattooers, Inc. TNA Division Champ, X Division Champ Austin Aries versus Brian Kendrick.
Actually, that match is on Facebook, that tag team match.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Bully Ray versus Mr. Anderson in a Falls Count Anywhere match. Full Metal Mayhem match with Rob Van Dam versus Jerry Lynn. We have Sting versus Hulk Hogan in a no DQ. If Sting wins, Dixie Carter regains control of TNA. And the main event, which should be a heck of a match, Kurt Angle versus Bobby Roode.
In a fight with Sting and Hogan?
What's that?
A fight with Sting and Hogan?
Might be okay.
He's already said he ain't taking no bumps, so he's he's really pushing this thing. It's going to be a battle. Did you see what he said about Robert Roode today?
No.
What do you say?
They were asking him about Robert Roode being in the main event, and Hogan says, quote, "Nah, he's not ready. He's not the next guy. You know, they might think he is. Dixie Carter might think he is. The whole world might think he is. He's not the next guy."
Wow.
Swear to God. That's a great way to push your pay-per-view main event.
He probably thinks he's talking about Christopher Daniels.
No. Although well, I could see him saying that about Daniels, and I'd probably think the same thing. But he has these comments on James Storm. He said, "I go with James Storm all day long. Mainstream brother, cowboy hat, beer drinking, middle America, NASCAR, Walmart, country western. I mean, all day long, it's a no-brainer. That's just me. That's my opinion." So, I mean, Bobby Roode's a tremendous athlete. I would change. I'd bill him from Venice Beach, California, or Omaha, Nebraska, but not Canada. Omaha, Nebraska is, like, better than Canada versus, like, I don't know. He's a fool
that can still cut an awesome promo.
Yeah, that was a good promo. That
was
that wrestling game sucks that he put out.
Yeah.
Horribly.
Somehow, some way, somehow, if he doesn't break a hip, there's a miracle going to happen Sunday night.
Now, there's one more pay-per-view this weekend, Craig. Can you read that real quick?
There is one more pay-per-view this weekend, and let me pull up my notes here. It is the AWE Night of Legends pay-per-view, and it is on Sunday. It'll be $24.95, and it's on
Saturday.
In-demand. Saturday, I'm sorry. It'll air at 9 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern. It'll be priced at $24.95 on in-demand and DirecTV in the U.S. and Canada. Listen to this lineup. The Rock and Roll Express versus Kevin Nash and a mystery partner, most likely Diamond Dallas Page. Tommy Dreamer versus Terry Funk and what will go down as their very first official match. Perry Saturn versus C.W. Anderson in Saturn's first match since 2002. Dave Finley versus Alex Silva with Buddy Landell. Sanjay Dutt versus Jamin Ovilianza. Okay, trust me on that one. Hacksaw Duggan versus Momar Akbar. The Midnight Express versus the Mulkeys.
Yay.
And Short Sleeve Samson versus Abo Shango. Also included to appear Amy Letus Dumas, Rhino, Tully Blanchard, Baby Doll, Tammy Sitch, Ivan Koloff, Tracy Smothers, George South, Chris Hamrick, and Rip Sawyer.
I'm very excited for this show.
You don't say.
The Midnight Express versus the Mulkeys in 2011. I don't know.
And George
The Rock and Roll Express against Kevin Nash in tag team match.
Whew.
To be late. He wrote the wrestling too.
Very possible.
It'll be better than Heroes of the Wrestling, too.
Yeah, Luke was not impressed with his match at the first Heroes of Wrestling.
He wasn't the only one.
Well, isn't that, like, considered, like, the worst match of all time in some people's opinion?
This one. Yeah,
I still thought the Tomko match where he beat the shit out of Stevie Richards in the drifts was one of the worst.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that
man,
was
that was horrible.
Yeah, that was pretty bad too.
and real quick, they'll put another thing about a DX appearance on SmackDown. Could you read that?
One more time, sorry.
Did you find it?
Oh, go ahead, Katrin.
I was gonna say there was a.
I got it.
Okay, go ahead.
DX teases WrestleMania could be in Dallas, Texas in 2013. Of course, we actually already knew that. Prior to this week's SmackDown taping in Dallas, Shawn Michaels and Triple H did a promo live for the arena where they teased WrestleMania could come to Dallas and led a chant for WrestleMania. Word from WWE is Dallas is a front runner for WrestleMania 2013. and reminded me of the time the radio DJ Andy Savage came out and introduced SmackDown to an audience in Seattle, and it said, "Aren't you people excited for WrestleMania?" And everybody went nuts, and he went back, and they told him, "What the F is wrong with you?" And it hasn't been announced yet, blah, 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 blah.
And that's the reason the buy rate was down, because he announced it too early.
Right. That must have been it.
But, yeah, WrestleMania here in Dallas, I'm thinking it's going to happen, so I'm very excited if it does. And Ed don't got to travel far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no kidding. It would be like taking this trip this past weekend and saving me a lot of money off the fucking airfare.
I don't have to go anywhere. I'm here in Dallas. I don't have to fly nowhere.
Cool. That'll be awesome. We can get Stone finally. But anyway, we'll go ahead and wrap up. Craig, any final thoughts or statements you'd like to make?
No, I'm good. I've said my piece. I'm working on a guest for next week. I don't want to give it away because he actually hasn't gotten back to me, but I'm pretty excited if this will pull through. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, and Katrina?
No, I have nothing to say.
We done said it all in the last hour and 41 minutes.
Anybody watch the season finale of Breaking Bad the other night?
I've never seen an episode, so no.
Yeah, I've never seen it before.
Oh, Walking Dead starts Sunday, Ed.
Yeah, I know. I can't wait for that. That's going to be pretty cool. Oh, by the way, I talked to you on that little side project we said we were going to do. Are you still working on those episodes?
The what?
Battlestar Galactica. Are you still watching Battlestar Galactica?
Oh, I watched like the first three. Then I got sidetracked because I was watching Wings, one of my favorite shows. So I got sidetracked.
Well, get back on track because Mike Kaufman has agreed to do a show about the show with us.
Okay, so I only have like 78 more episodes to go.
You also need to check out Razor too.
Razor too?
I don't know that. Yeah, Razor is like a little one-off movie that they made. It happens between season 3 and 4.
And didn't they have a prequel that lasted maybe one season?
They had a prequel movie called The Plan, and then they also had another series called Caprica that didn't last very long. That one was a little harder to get into. I am hearing that they are going to make it another runoff series where it's a younger Adama actually being a captain of a Battlestar and them fighting and the time out. So that one would probably do a lot better, but yeah, just finish the show. But it just look at the name of the movie I'm talking about is called Razor, and it's actually pretty goddamn awesome. So it's kind of,
They don't have any droids or anything on the show. I ain't seen no droids or nothing. Any droids?
You know, hot blonde robots aren't hot enough for you. You want to see?
I haven't seen any female robots.
The blonde dude, it's Caprica, fucking Cylon.
Oh, she's a robot.
Fucking Dina the Warrior Prince is a freaking robot.
I must not got to that plot twist yet. Thanks for ruining it for me.
You haven't seen Gina yet? She was on season 3.
I don't know. I don't even know what we're talking about.
Never mind. Anyway, Gina the Warrior Princess comes out of Battlestar Galactica. She's one of the Cylons. She's a bitch. But anyway, go ahead and wrap up before Katrina pisses me off for getting fucking characters.
I must have missed
Battlestar
that story arc where Gina was a robot. Are you saying the woman that played Xena shows up as a robot?
They're robots that look like humans, dude.
Yes, they're called cyborgs. So everybody come
one
back
with,
next
with
week
from,
and check out Over the Top
Radio.
To kill a little child once, and then
that
we had Judgment
awesome
Day.
Yeah. Yeah, that was an awesome. Anyway, we'll go ahead and wrap up, and we'll be back next week. And and hopefully Craig will be joining us for 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah, we'll see what happens.
Everyone, come back next week. We'll talk to everybody then.
You gotta beat the man! You gotta beat the man! You wanna- haven't found out how good you are, you're looking at the American shit. Let's go hook them up. Tonight.